Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's 8:06 on this Wednesday, May 28th. 55 degrees currently here in Old Town Park City, 57 degrees in Heber Valley. And on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Cedric Haynes. Good morning.
Good morning, KPCW listeners. It's time for your Wednesday forecast for the Wasatch Back. We're looking at high temperatures climbing today up into the 80s across portions of the Wasatch Back as we go throughout this afternoon, as we see lots of sunshine showing up across the area. And Park City will hold into the mid-70s with partly cloudy skies. There will be a chance for a few afternoon pop-up showers and downpours developing, but don't let that cancel your outdoor plans. As we go into your Thursday, how about highs in the upper 70s for Park City? We'll see those highs climbing into the low to mid-80s. In the Heber Valley there, we will have a chance of a few pop-up showers developing. Otherwise, it should just be on the warm and summer-like side across the region. As we get towards the end of the week, look for that sunshine to build more as high pressure gets stronger across the area. So I think high temperatures start to climb into the low 80s in Park City. We'll see those highs in the upper 80s in the Heber Valley, again, with lots of sunshine. That sunshine sticks around with us as we go into the weekend. It's going to be a hot one, folks. We're talking high temperatures on Saturday climbing into the low to mid 80s in Park City. Highs will climb into the low 90s for the Heber Valley. By Sunday, we're looking at lots of sunshine, highs climbing into the low 80s in Park City. Highs will be into the upper 80s in the Heber Valley. And then as we head into next week, we'll see a stronger storm system arriving. That'll bring us a good chance of scattered showers and storms. And along with that better chance of showers and storms, it's also going to bring us some much cooler air. So high temperatures by the time we get towards next Monday in Park City will only be in the upper 60s, with highs only in the low 70s in the Heber Valley. By the time we get towards Tuesday, we're looking at highs only around 60 in Park City and high temperatures only in the mid to upper 60s for the Heber Valley, with again a good chance of scattered showers and thunderstorms. So a much more active pattern to head our way as we get towards the beginning of next week. But between now and then, just a few pop-up showers today and tomorrow afternoon, and then we're looking at mainly dry and hot conditions as we move throughout the weekend. That's your latest forecast from the ABC 4 Weather Center. That's a look at your weather for your Wednesday for the Wasatch Back. Have a great day.
Well, stay tuned. Coming up in just a minute, we'll be checking in with the executive director of the Snyderville Basin Water Reclamation District, Mike Lors. Later on, Summit Pride members Virginia Solomon and Rebecca Brenner with details on the June Pride Month programming. Mediator and author Chad Ford is joined by Mountain Mediation Programs Director Chris Campbell with details on Ford's visit to Park City later this week, focused on understanding conflict and how to turn it into meaningful connection. Finally, from the Ecker Hill Middle School, PTO President Brittany Bailey and parent organizer Coy Collar with details on the school's year-end community events. Then stay tuned for The Mountain Live. This week kicks off a new monthly segment called Resilient Youth, exploring all the forces that shape and influence our young people to become happy, healthy, and to thrive. The first segment features Live Like Sam co-founder Skylar Jackenthal, who talks about her new podcast, Good Grief, Life After Loss. Then Dr. Ailey Cohen, a board-certified rheumatologist and integrative medicine physician, discusses her new book, Detoxify the Everyday Toxins Harming Your Immune System. All of that coming up on The Mountain Life, of course, heard every Wednesday from 9 to 10. In the studio now with an update from the Snyderville Basin Water Reclamation District, I have Executive Director Mike Lors. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning, Leslie.
So let's start off, as we always do, with the flush index, basically a way to estimate visitor nights.
Yeah, so for the month of April, we estimated that there were 102,271 visitor nights. Comparing that to April of 2024, it was down about 10%. If you look at it year to date, however, we are up about 2.6%. So while April is down, year to date's up a couple percent.
Okay. Let's see. What's the weekly wastewater surveillance summary tell us?
So we continue to monitor for the SARS-CoV-2 virus, which is, you know, responsible for COVID, twice a week at each of our wastewater treatment facilities, as do many wastewater facilities across the state. Good news is that in most locations, including ours, the levels are very, very low, and we hope to be able to continue this program. As we mentioned previously, what we call wastewater-based epidemiology is really up and coming. However, with some recent cuts to health departments, we're not sure what's going to happen in the future.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. When do we end this? Basically, I mean, we've heard that we're already starting to see a pullback by the White House administration for COVID vaccines for certain populations.
Yeah, wastewater-based epidemiology is a great way to continue to monitor the health of a population, and it's relatively simple. You obviously take wastewater samples and you check it for influenza or mpox or whatever. And many countries are going that direction because it's a relatively inexpensive way to get a big snapshot of a population. I do know here in Utah, the Salt Lake Health Department would like to expand this, but that's kind of up in the air right now with questions about funding.
So when do you find out whether or not it continues?
Well, as of 2 weeks ago, they said what we're doing currently will continue, but there's a question mark about the future.
Mm-hmm. And then in terms of what you would like to see, I mean, is it the COVID-19 that you'd like to see, or is there something else that I think it's more important to the community?
You know, we are wastewater providers, and working with the health department and CDC, those are the folks that are in the driver's seat as to what is sampled for. But they have made it clear that wastewater-based epidemiology is something that will be used in the future, and influenza, mpox, those type of things are what they'll be looking for.
Okay. Well, it's that time of year for sump pumps. What do people need to know?
So if you have a sump pump, give us a call. We'd like to get your permission to inspect your sump pump. And if for some reason it's connected to the wastewater system, which it's not supposed to be connected, we have a program to help you pay to get that disconnected. And we've been very successful in the last 2 years in working with dozens and dozens of homeowners. And this helps prevent overloading the wastewater system. It helps prevent backups into your home. And quite honestly, clean water in our system is not a good thing, because our treatment plants need the waste from all of us to feed to our microscopic organisms to treat. And if thousands and hundreds of thousands of gallons of clean water enter our system, it really harms our treatment facilities. So if you have a sump pump, give us a call. And we do have a very generous reimbursement program.
Yeah, you mentioned it's free for your folks to come out and check. And then, I mean, what are you talking about in terms of cost? I mean, what would it cost somebody to...
These things can cost as little as, you know, a couple bucks to thousands of dollars. And our reimbursement program gets up into the thousands of dollars. You know, it's a matter of, do you have a location to put the water? Meaning, do you have a ditch behind your house? Do you have a creek? Do you have a storm drain? If you have a storm drain out front, you know, that's a great place to connect it. So it really gets down to, where can the clean water that your sump pump is pumping, where can it go? And we work with you and give you recommendations and suggestions and help you pay for it.
Yeah. And why are they hooked up incorrectly to begin with?
Because it's an easy way to get rid of water. If you have a basement or a sump pump and someone is installing that for you, unfortunately, it's just too convenient to tap into the wastewater line to get rid of it. And it is illegal. It does not meet plumbing code. And unfortunately, even in the last 10 years, quite a few sump pumps have been connected improperly.
So how come that isn't found during, you know, routine inspections?
Well, if someone calls a plumber and says, I want a sump pump, and they connect it, there's no inspection involved.
Okay. Let's see. You got your district crews out and about?
Yes. As we do every summer, we often have many pipelines that are in need of what we call rehabilitation. And this is where we put a new pipe inside the old pipe without any digging involved. It's a process that was involved, invented over in Europe. If you see our crews out in the street, hey, go out and say hi to them. And if you got a question as to what they're doing, they'd be happy to answer your questions. But, you know, the good news is we have over 50 pipeline segments that we'll be working on throughout our service district here in Park City in the Snyderville Basin. You know, feel free to come up to the crews and see what they're doing.
So is the work that we see along State Route 224 replacing those liners?
That's actually a new water line. That's a joint venture between Park City, Mountain Regional, and Summit Water.
Okay. It looks like liners, but it's just they're replacing the pipeline.
You'll see a black pipe out there. It's called high-density polyethylene pipe that they'll be installing.
Okay. And you're also asking people not to cover up manhole covers. And what are you seeing manhole covers being covered with?
So frequently, if you have a manhole cover, say, in the alley behind your home or between your home and your neighbors, we are seeing a lot of landscaping activity covering those up. And that's a real problem, because if we need to get into that system to, say, unblock the sewer line because someone flushed flushable wipes, as an example, we need to get in there very quickly, and we don't need to spend hours and hours looking where the manhole is. So we are seeing some folks covering those up with mulch and even planting trees around them, and don't do that. You know, keep them open so that we can find them to provide good service to you.
And again, I mean, how was it that these were put in these weird spots anyway?
Well, sewer lines are installed in order so that the wastewater flows by gravity through them. And that dictates kind of where they need to go. Most of them are in streets, but we do have many, many, many miles of pipelines in people's backyards and ski slopes and alleys, so they can pretty much be anywhere.
Okay. Let's see. We have heard so much about tariffs. Is the Water Reclamation District being affected by these?
Yes, we are. Our two advanced wastewater plants, you know, we're able to provide the high level of treatment because we use very sophisticated equipment that is sourced worldwide. And we recently made some purchases of some odor control equipment out of Canada. You know, the purchase was only $6,400, but we had to pay a $1,550 tariff on it. Some chemicals that we use on a daily basis, those raw materials come from overseas. We're seeing a 10% tariff on that. We recently made an order for some large equipment at our East Canyon facility. It's almost $1 million purchase. And hopefully that will be covered by the Mexican-Canadian Free Trade Agreement. If not, there'll be about a $220,000 tariff on that one single purchase. So being a wastewater utility that secures, you know, supplies and equipment from around the world, we'll see in the effect of tariffs on multiple items.
So is this become a prelude to rate increases?
The question is, what will be the future of these tariffs? Are they going to be short-lived? Are they going to be long-lived? Certainly, if we're paying a 25% tariff on big equipment, you know, that's going to have a very negative impact on our budget, and we would have to you know, pass that cost on.
Okay. And you've kind of held back on the expansion of East Canyon?
We have. The expansion of the East Canyon facility is estimated to cost right now about $130 million. Two reasons we're holding off. One, we'd really like interest rates to come down. And certainly in this uncertain time right now with tariffs and all, we don't want to get involved with that currently. And we still have enough capacity to meet the current growth needs of the community. So we're okay. But when you spend $130 million, a good portion of that cost is purchasing equipment from overseas, and we're taking a really close look at that.
Yeah, and what we're hearing, I mean, we heard that at the Economic Summit, that Summit County is actually losing people over the next decade. But I think we're talking about year-round, you know, full-time folks.
Right.
At the same time, we may see increases in the tourist economy, right, which you still need to plan for.
Yeah, we're just like the water company. We have to design our facilities to meet the peak day demand, and that's generally between Christmas and New Year's when the resorts are all loaded up. So our demand really is not driven by the permanent residents. It's driven by the overall ski industry that we see during the wintertime.
Okay. You also have some other helpful tips. You did mention flushable wipes, which, in fact, are not.
So, once again, I was at Costco the other day, and they had flushable wipes, and they said flushable. They are flushable. Unfortunately, they're not treatable. So if you use any kind of body wipe, please do not flush them. Put them in the trash. If you do flush them, there's a chance it'll stop up your home lines and back up sewage into your home. So avoid that by not flushing what they call flushable wipes. And this goes for cooking oils and greases as well. So, you know, put those type things in a trash can or recycle them.
Okay. Mike, anything else you want to mention?
Oh, that's it. Thank you, Leslie.
All right. Thank you. Mike Lors is the Executive Director of the Snyderville Basin Water Reclamation District. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. One person has died after a semi-truck collided with an SUV on North US 40 Tuesday morning. KPCW's Grace Dorfler reports that multiple lanes were closed for hours as crews investigated the crash.
A silver SUV was turning left onto the highway to go south when a semi-trailer couldn't avoid it and collided with the vehicle. Utah Highway Patrol Corporal Jared Haywood said it happened at about 8:15 on May 27th.
The Nissan Xterra attempted to make a left-hand turn in front of the Kenworth, and the Kenworth was unable to stop in time, T-boning the Xterra.
The SUV driver, the only person in the car, died at the scene. Their name has not yet been released. The crash at mile marker 15 near the Coyote Ridge neighborhood is under investigation. Lane closures slowed traffic for hours Tuesday as UHP troopers funneled vehicles to the shoulders of the road. 40 reopened at about 1 p.m. In 2023 and 2024 alone, the Utah Department of Transportation says there were nearly 100 crashes on the five-mile stretch of US 40 between River Road and 1200 South, with three fatalities. The deadly crash Tuesday marked the fourth person killed there over the last few years. This latest incident comes after UDOT shared plans to install concrete barriers and three traffic lights on the highway, specifically to make left turns safer. UDOT regional spokesperson Wyatt Woolley said Tuesday the agency hopes to add a traffic light at the intersection of 40 and Coyote Canyon Parkway by the end of summer. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
The Summit Pride Foundation is gearing up for Pride Month, June 1st. In the studio with details, I have Summit Pride member Virginia Solomon, hoping that Rebecca Brenner can join us. You may be stuck in traffic. Good morning, Virginia.
Morning, Leslie. Thanks so much for having us.
Yeah, first start by telling us what Summit Pride is.
Yeah, so Summit Pride is our local grassroots LGBTQ plus advocacy and community building organization. We kind of think that we operate in two lanes. One is talking with allies, working with education and advocacy, and then the other lane is community building for us, for the queer folks in town.
Okay. So has Summit Pride always been a foundation? Because when I was looking at the introduction, it was like, oh, I didn't know that they were a foundation.
Yeah, absolutely. And it is something that we learned as we were going through the 501c3 incorporation process last summer, that that was a word that we needed to have in our name for the structure that we were wanting to have. But certainly we started as an internal municipal task force with Park City, and then moved to this kind of quasi community organization that still was located within the city, and we've settled as our own C3.
Great. All right. The group does have several events planned, as I mentioned, starting with the Pride Month kickoff. That's this Sunday, June 1st. So when and where is that?
Yeah, absolutely. So we're meeting. We're going to start together at PCMR at the lot just below the buses so that it's easy for people to get to. Gather there around 4:30, start to march just down Lowell Avenue to Park Avenue, up to City Park, and then have a party starting at City Park at 5:30. So for folks who don't feel like marching, please feel free to join us at the park. There'll be food and beverage available for purchase. If you just feel like marching and don't want to hang out at the park, that also is great. We'd love to have you, but hopefully all of it will be a fun time.
Okay, you've got live music?
We do, yep, live music. We have a performance by Talia Keys, who's a fantastic musician that Mountain Town Music kind of helped us learn about, and we all love her now, and so look forward to meeting her. And then we also will have drag and DJ performances throughout the evening.
Okay, and again, it's just free to show up and to participate in the march?
Absolutely, just a little bit of energy to walk.
Okay, and then you've got a number of other events. You want to just run through them? I mean, next Thursday, June 12th, I should say, a couple weeks, you've got a free film screen. Tell me about this.
Yeah, absolutely. And so we'll be screening the kind of infamous, canonical documentary, Paris is Burning, that is about the kind of late 80s, early 90s drag ball scene in New York City, really focusing on how that community of predominantly BIPOC folks, BIPOC trans folks, BIPOC queer folks, really kind of found belonging and love and support at a time when many of them, as they talk about in the film, were kind of kicked out of their homes and didn't have access to more accessible forms of community. And so that is an event in partnership with Park City Film and also with Mountain Mediation. There'll be a community conversation that's hosted afterwards. So that's our event on the 12th. Then on the 14th, we are kind of partnering with the library to host an author event, a trans woman who was previously fairly high up in the LDS church, has written a memoir. And so there's an event with her and other kind of local queer authors, and there'll be sort of, I think, craft events as well. And then on the end of the month, on the 29th, we are having our Pride on the Mountain Day at Deer Valley, and that's going to be a super, super fun day of just kind of mountain biking and hiking. There'll be a DJ, all of the events that Deer Valley is going to have all summer, not events, but you know, food trucks and beer trucks and those sorts of things will be there, and we'll have an opportunity drawing, and it'll be a great, fun day outside, really appreciating what makes our community in Park City really an integral part of the queer community, right? We're part of Park City, and Park City also is part of us.
All right, so that happens, what, starting at about 10? I mean, kind of an all-day event?
Yep, exactly, all day.
And then you've got lift tickets actually benefiting Summit Pride?
Exactly, yep. Right. Yep, and so, you know, they'll be, obviously we'll be there accepting donations, your opportunity drawing tickets will go to Summit Pride, and then also a portion of those lift tickets will go to Summit Pride. And then before we move on, I also want to promote our Raise the Flag initiative that is ongoing. And basically, if folks aren't familiar, a bill called HB 77 passed the state legislature this year outlawing the flying of pride flags from municipal property. And so what we're hoping with this initiative is that we can just flood the Wasatch back with rainbows, that there's so many businesses and private residences that are flying these flags that you don't even notice that they're missing from city property. So flags are available for pickup at the Park City Community Foundation. There is a QR code there if you're so inclined to donate. We're, of course, happy to accept that, but we want to get the flags out more than we want this to be a fundraiser. So please, folks, I'm going to keep tabs. Hopefully we don't run out. Hopefully we have enough. But there are flags there available for pickup at the Park City Community Foundation, and they're open kind of during normal business hours.
Okay. So in years past, as we recall, you have raised the flag at Miners Hospital, but again, no longer allowed to do that?
Right. Yeah. Internally, I've been calling our June 1st event not to raise the flag, but we thought that that was bad messaging.
Okay. Well, welcome to Rebecca Brenner. What else have you got planned?
Well, Virginia did an amazing job, thank you, of covering our June activities. I think I'd like to just toss in, too, that Summit Pride runs a parent group for kiddos, for parents that have kiddos in the queer community, and we meet once a month. And we are a small but mighty group. And if people are interested in joining, they can just email me, RebeccaSBrenner@gmail.com. And then in July, 4th of July parade, Summit Pride will be joining the parade here on Main Street. And we would love anyone to come and join us that would like to support Summit Pride.
All right. In terms of just the organization, the Pride organization, do you guys meet monthly and people are welcome to attend, or how does that work?
Absolutely. So we meet every other month as the sort of larger group. We have leadership meetings roughly monthly on a bit more ad hoc of a basis that the public also is kind of welcome to sit in on if they'd like. A large part of what we're trying to do is kind of contribute to leadership development. And so that, in addition to kind of transparency, we welcome people if they'd like. Obviously, they're non-voting, but to sit in on those leadership conversations. But if folks would like to come to those every other month meetings, if you just go to our website, summitpride.org, you'll see a contact form that'll get you to me, and I'll put you on our email list, and then you'll be notified of those meetings. And all our events also are listed on that summitpride.org.
All right. And with the recent legislation that we have seen here in the state of Utah, have you seen any kind of social backlash against the state? I mean, kind of maybe not coming to the state like Queer Ski Week or, you know, something like that? Just kind of trying to make an economic impact statement?
And I think we already see drops in tourism to the United States in general. since January and the change of administration and what has kind of played out of worst fears in terms of how the administration would approach kind of cultural issues and our foreign friends. And I haven't seen numbers yet. I guess we should have asked Jen when she was on here yesterday about that. But I haven't seen numbers for Utah in particular. But I think what we have seen actually are positives to a certain extent. So gestures like Aaron Mendenhall adopting Pride and Juneteenth flags as official Salt Lake City flags is a way to be able to fly those. The wonderful leadership that was demonstrated by our high schoolers a few weeks ago in terms of having their rainbow breakfast and wrapping the PC in rainbow colors. And so we certainly have seen examples in other states that have adopted legislation that has become kind of somewhat infamous. So, for example, in 2017, North Carolina's HB2, which was a bathroom bill, led to notable economic loss for that state. And so it's hard to imagine that that won't impact Utah to some extent, but I think we haven't seen it quite yet.
Yeah. And what is the genesis of the rainbow flag?
Yeah, so in the 70s, this is history that I have looked up, and of course now I'm forgetting, but in the 70s, it was a group in San Francisco kind of came up with this idea. You read histories about it, and it was like massive, and these people, they didn't, it's not like they had an office or a warehouse, and so they're in their San Francisco walk-ups needing to figure out how to store hundreds of feet of fabric that they put together to assemble this flag. But when we're talking about the 70s, we're talking about the beginnings of a national large-scale gay rights organization in the U.S., and so it was an early moment of trying to demonstrate sort of pride, unity, and community. Okay. And so that's why it's important, because having cities, municipalities fly that flag shows that the LGBTQ plus community is a valued and important part of the larger places where we all live and contribute.
Okay. So if people do want a flag, you've got them available. Park City Community Foundation, just need to stop by or call or show up.
And yeah, just yeah. Stop by if you're worried that they might be closed. We're getting to summer informal hours, so it might be worth it if you're at the beginning or the end of the day giving a call. Sorry, Community Foundation, for maybe flooding your phone lines for a little bit. But go ahead, stop by. Please grab a flag. The goal is just to have the town covered in rainbows.
Okay. Anything else you want to mention?
No, just come out and enjoy Pride Month with us. It'd be great to see everyone there.
Okay. Again, you're meeting at Park City Mountain Resort parking lot 4:30 on Sunday.
Correct.
Okay.
Look forward to seeing everybody.
Regina Solomon, Rebecca Brenner, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you.
International peace builder, mediator, and author Chad Ford will be in Park City for one night. In the studio with details, I have programs director for Mountain Mediation Center, Chris Campbell. Chad Ford joins us on the line. Good morning to both of you. Chris, maybe you start off and just kind of give us a little bit of background on the event, when, where.
Sure. So we're excited to have Chad Ford come join us on June 1st. This is in partnership with Park City Performing Arts. He'll be at the Echo Center at the high school from 6 to 7:30 p.m. You can find links to tickets on our website at mountainmediationcenter.org.
Okay. It's not a free event, but tickets are pretty reasonable.
Yeah, $10. And if you have any challenges with that, we've got some, you know, you can reach out to us. We want to make sure that people are welcome to come, so we'll help you get in the seat.
All right. Chad, tell us a little bit about yourself, what you do, and why you're coming to Park City.
Yeah, I'm really excited to join Mountain Mediation there in Park City. I'm a professor at Utah State with the Harabi Peace Institute. And for the last 20 years, I was started an intercultural peace building major and program out in Hawaii. I'm a conflict mediator by trade. I've worked in conflicts throughout the world, most prominently in the Middle East, in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict for the last 20 years. But I've done everything from child custody cases to working with organizations like Nike and the U.S. Olympic team, right up into international conflicts, and have written a book called Dangerous Love that really encapsulates my 20 years of doing mediation work and helps other people navigate how to navigate their own conflicts.
Yeah, so when we talk about conflict, I mean, what are we talking about? I mean, certainly on a national level, we're talking about very different ideological beliefs, or are we talking more personal conflict, a couple going through divorce, or just dealing with a teenager who knows everything?
Well, it turns out that most people are, frankly, likely dealing with multiple types of conflicts that you're describing, right? Whether that's a partner that I'm in a relationship with, whether that's parenting, whether that's someone that I'm working with at an organization. Certainly, we're seeing community conflict and political polarization ripping apart communities and countries. And then we see these larger international conflicts that are around us. And as it turns out, the skills to navigate conflict in a constructive way. I'm a big believer that conflict in and of itself is not a negative thing. It can actually be a really positive thing. But because we often lack the skills and we approach conflict with a lot of fear, it often feels like it is the worst thing that could possibly be happening to us. But I find that the skills involved in navigating all of those various types of conflict that we just described are pretty universal. And so I try to focus on what is the conflict that is closest to you, because that's going to be the one that's going to be the easiest for you to be able to get your arms around. How do I navigate that in a constructive way, in a way that both meets my needs as well as meets the needs of the other person or group of people that I'm in conflict with? And then from there, I can start to skill up to the conflicts that are a little bit further away from me than the ones that are closest in.
And as you mentioned, your work with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, I mean, you've got two groups with their heels dug deep in the sand. How do you even get any movement from resolution there?
Well, you can see that 20 years working there, I've been doing a great job. Obviously, given the the real serious conflict that's there, it's really hard, and it's a long-term process, and it's happening at two levels. So some of it is happening at the larger scale diplomatic level. What are leaders doing? How do mediators step in that work for governments and for nonprofit organizations to help bring them to agreement? But just as importantly, and I think this is a point that's often missed by us, is what is happening on the ground? What is happening with everyday individual Israelis and Palestinians to help prepare them for peace? We call this grassroots peace building. And I focused a lot of attention in both spaces, but I actually think it's where the grassroots peace building that's the most invisible. We don't see it quite as clearly. It's not going to make the news on a night-to-night basis, but I've worked with dozens of communities that are Israeli and Palestinian, working together to figure out ways to collaboratively solve problems, to help each other see each other as people, to figure out ways of working together. And while the larger conflict continues to remain just horrific at the moment, there are all of these things that are happening on the ground in these individual communities with everyday Israelis and Palestinians that I think are starting to move the needle in some really important ways. And again, it often starts close in, right? Who are my neighbors? Who are the people that are closest to me? If I don't feel like I can move the needle nationally, how do I move it locally? And I think that these are skills that people often don't think about when we start thinking about these larger scale conflicts. I'm so focused on the big conflict that I forget that there's a series of small conflicts between people that are often fueling the larger one.
Yeah, and you know, you think about it, the people just living day to day, they don't want to see any of this, right? I mean, they just want a better life for their families and children, and yet, you know, they've got the folks representing them on a national basis kind of dictating everything, where it's like almost impossible. I mean, there just seems to be such a huge chasm between, again, those that just want to live life and those that are fighting for some, I don't know, unattainable purpose.
I think that's exactly right. And I was just recently over there in February, and it's the same. They're talking, interestingly enough, about the same sort of things, like I want a good marriage. I want to create a great life for my children. I want to have economic stability. I want to be able to enjoy life and have freedom of movement. And these larger issues that are happening in the conflict are curtailing all of that. But when you get down to it, for many of these people, it's that dream and that desire to just have a better life for their children that they are caught up in something that is often bigger than them. And frankly, when we think about political conflict in many, many spaces, not just here, you see that the extremes on both sides of the conflict often are dictating what is happening. And that becomes very, very frustrating for everyday people. But also there's a lot that everyday people can do. And I'm always excited to work with organizations like Mountain Mediation that are thinking about how do we give these skills to everyday people? How do we think about solving problems locally in our community? How do we create patterns where conflict moves from destructive to constructive? And I've just found that for the most part, we lack these skills. We lack these mental pathways of thinking about how to see a way forward. And so we get frustrated, we get angry, we get upset, and it feels like conflict is always happening to us, but we're not actually participating in it, especially in a way that could actually lead to any sort of transformation or resolution.
Okay, so the title of your speech is The Courage to Listen, Turning Conflict into Collaboration. What are a couple of the lessons that you hope people can walk away with?
Well, I often find that when we're in conflict, there's a couple of things that are happening that often keep us from following the best practices. The first is that we're experiencing a certain level of fear. What is going to happen to us? Why is this happening? What does this say about my relationship? What does this say about my community? And when we are experiencing a lot of fear, our brains shut down and we don't actually often think through collaborative solutions to problems. We get caught in a fight or flight type of mentality. And because we're caught in this mentality, collaborative problem solving, which is typically what we're going for, right, in relationships, in community, it's really, really hard to see that. So we're going to spend some time thinking about our approaches to conflict, how we see conflict, how it affects our ability to navigate conflict effectively. And then the second thing that I notice, and partly the title, is that I live in a very assumptive world. When other people do things that are frustrating to me, that are hard for me, that feel offensive, I typically jump to a lot of conclusions about why they're reacting that way, why are they acting that way, and then I respond in kind. And we're going to talk in this workshop and practice some skills about how we reflect, how we take a pause, how we ask good questions, how we listen to understand instead of listen to come up with our points that we're going to defend, and how we start to incorporate what we're learning in our listening to be able to help us find a solution that not only works for them, but works for us as well.
Okay. Chris, how did you find out about Chad?
Well, first of all, I had his book sitting in my house for a time, and it was on my stack of reading lists, and I got through it, and I've just found it really, really crystallizes the key skills, as Chad is talking about, concrete, everyday things that we can do in our own conflicts to start to make a difference. And the title of his book is Dangerous Love. In there, he talks about how dangerous love is a strong thing, that dangerous love requires action, and it can transform entire systems of conflict. And so I really liked that framing, that it's not about passivity or just, you know, taking whatever comes at you, but it's really about strongly stepping into looking at conflict in a healthier, more productive way and having the courage to do that.
Okay. So again, the event is this Sunday, June 1st, at the Park City Eccles Theater, starting at 6, running through 7:30. Tickets are online where?
MountainMediationCenter.org.
Okay. Anything else, Chad, you'd like to add?
I'm just really excited. I hope people come out and they bring a conflict with them. And we're going to try to navigate that in an hour and a half. And hopefully people walk out of there with a few tools that say, hey, I'm more confident stepping into this conflict. And I have some hope that I'm going to be able to resolve it.
Okay. Appreciate your time, Chad. And Chris, anything else you want to add?
Nope. We look forward to seeing you on Sunday. Thanks for having us, Leslie.
In the studio now with an update on some year-end community events. I have PTO President for Ecker Hill Middle School, Brittany Bailey, along with parent organizer, Coy Kohler. Good morning.
Good
Thanks
morning.
For joining us.
Thanks for
Thank
having
you.
Us.
Brittany, you want to just kind of start off with just, you've got this Ecker Hill Middle School summer kickoff party happening?
We do. We're very excited. So June 5th, Townlift Plaza will be hosting our annual summer kickoff party. This is one of our biggest fundraisers of the year. This year it's more important than ever. We have eighth grade coming to Ecker next year, so we're needing a few extra funds going into this next school year. But it's just a fun event. It's for the community. It's a great time to celebrate the incoming sixth grade class of next year. year, as well as for our current Ecker Middle School students and their families. But we do welcome the community since we're right here off Main Street. So we will have food for sale and drinks, and we have local community partners out there. It's a free event so anyone can walk up and join us. And Koi's been doing an amazing job planning it, so I'll let her share a little bit more of the details.
Okay. We're super excited. Like Brittany said, it's going to be from 5 to 8 p.m. at the Townlift Plaza. All of the food has been sponsored and donated by the Bridge Cafe and Devonza's Pizza, so we're really grateful to them. They've done it year after year and it's made this event a huge success. We'll also have some beers and cocktails by PC Brewing and Simplicity Cocktails, and then a lot of fun games and activities and live music from our Ecker Hill Middle School Jazz Band Choir, and then also a local band called PC Rocks. So they'll be out there performing. Really great community event. And then also we have a bunch of vendors coming, and they'll be providing goodies and a lot of fun and joy for everyone.
Okay, free entrance, but you're going to make your money with the food and beverage sales then. Is that how it's going to work?
Correct.
That's how it's going to work.
And we'll have an opportunity drawing as well. So hopefully that'll help bring in a little bit more funds for the next year.
Okay. Do you get people just from the community outside of Ecker Hills? Yeah,
we do. I think, you know, we're full on into tourist season now, right? We kick that off with Memorial Day again. So we have a lot of people, I think, that hear the music and, you know, see the festivity, and they'll walk up for Main Street and just kind of ask, like, what's going on here? You know, they're also free to enjoy the vendors and purchase pizza or hamburgers or drinks.
Okay. So what do you plan to do with the money that you raise? I mean, you mentioned you've got an additional class that's staying there.
Right. Yeah. We'll have over 900 students at Ecker next year. The big portion of our budget goes to give back to our teachers. So we do a lot with teacher appreciation. We also, you know, we fund teacher grants in the classrooms in addition to what our wonderful Park City Education Foundation does. And we also try to give back to our students as well. You know, middle school can be an awkward time. I don't know about your time in middle school. I feel like mine was bad haircuts and awkward social situations. But no, these kids, they're wonderful. We really do want to give back to them. So we use it to fund. We also have coming up on June 4th, we call it our year-end party over at Ecker, where it's basically middle school field day. And so it's a really fun way to end the school year there for all of our students. And so we use our funds for those activities. We funded the school play in the past. We also fund positive behavioral intervention for our students. So it's a great incentive program. We partner with the teachers there for that, and just really coming alongside the administration to provide a little extra support where it's needed throughout the school year. And so we're excited to welcome the eighth grade class and keep that going.
Okay. Yeah, I was going to say, with the eighth graders basically staying at Ecker, I mean, anything special for them?
We do. We're actually planning next year, which Koi will have an eighth grader next year. Yes. So she's going to, I think, plan that for us. We want to have a really special send-off for the eighth grade before they head off to high school. So we're currently already working on that. So that'll be a day separate from what the sixth and seventh graders enjoy. And we've already been talking with some local partners, including Woodward, about what that might look like for next year.
Yeah, maybe just a fun like Woodward Day party, or some have talked about maybe a school dance. We'll see. Kind of have to look at the student body and get their ideas as well, and then work with the PTO to find out what's going to be best for everyone. But we're excited.
Okay, and then welcoming all of the fifth graders who are going to be at Ecker for the first time together.
Yes.
So especially like to see them, right?
We do. We love to see them. We've already reached out to all of the local elementary school PTOs to get the word out about our summer kickoff event. Really hoping that those fifth grade families will come and join us, and including Wileman. We know Wileman's not specifically in the district, but we know some of the students will matriculate over to Ecker. So we're really hoping to see them there so they can start getting a feel of middle school life.
Okay. Again, this is happening on Thursday, June 5th, Townlift Plaza, starting at 5 o'clock. Need any more help?
We are still looking for some sponsors. If anyone's out there, willing to help us out with some waters and fun little items that as giveaways, we'll take them. We're happy to have them and share them. But yes, volunteers, we're definitely looking for more volunteers. So if you're a parent out there with a student in middle school or in the elementaries, or you just want to come out and help support us, please let us know and we'll get you on that volunteer list.
Okay. Is there a way to reach out?
Yes. So they can actually go to our website, ehmspto.org. Through that, they can reach out to the PTO directly. That'll actually come directly to me. And then they can also pre-buy their dinner as well. So we have pre-sales up already for a pizza dinner or a burger dinner. And that just lets us be prepared. So when they arrive, food is ready for them and lets us know how many folks we might expect.
Okay. Anything else you want to add?
No, we just hope to see you out there. And thank you for letting us talk about it a little. We're so excited to have it this year.
Okay. Yes, thank you so much.
You bet. That's Brittany Bailey and Coy Kohler with Ecker Hill Middle School. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. Wasatch County's annual Demolition Derby and Mountain Valley Stampede presale tickets are only available in person through today. The county's Park and Recreation Department said that it made early ticket sales in person only after seeing an increase in scammers and technical challenges over the past few years. Tickets will be available for the late July events today from 3 to 8 p.m. at the Wasatch County Rec Center. Residents are limited to 10 tickets each. Tickets will be available online starting June 9th. The Demolition Derby runs July 24th through the 26th. The rodeo is happening July 31st to August 2nd, all taking place at the Wasatch County Outdoor Arena in Heber City. Utah has opened its 46th state park just outside of Moab. Utah Raptor State Park was created after lawmakers passed House Bill 257 during the 2021 state legislative session. It allowed the Division of Parks and Recreation to turn parts of Grand County's Dalton Wells area into the state park. The bill appropriated $36.5 million from the 2022 general fund to the Department of Natural Resources to complete the park. The park is named after the Utah raptor, whose fossils were first discovered in 1975 and have only been found in Utah. The DNR says that many of the fossils came from the Dalton Wells Quarry, home to one of the largest dinosaur bone beds in North America. More than 50 dinosaur species have been recovered from the quarry, 28 of which have not been found outside of Grand County. The park, about 15 miles northwest of Moab, opened May 23rd. It offers paved campsites with water and electricity hookups for RVs, picnic tables, flush restrooms, and showers. The park has OHV trailhead and mountain bike trail system access as well. And the Utah Department of Transportation is warning residents about a tolling scam that claims drivers have unpaid balances. The department said the scam text and calls seeking personal information reported earlier this year have wrapped up over the last few days. UDOT's main office received more than 500 inquiries last week asking about the validity of these texts and calls. Utah's transportation department said it does not send texts nor make phone calls to collect tolling fees. UDOT urges anyone who gets a call or text about an outstanding toll balance not to provide any payment information and to contact the department. Well, the Summit County Sheriff's Office is asking kids to be careful and parents to educate their families on e-bike safety. KPCW's Connor Thomas reports that there have already been a couple of close calls in the Pine Brook area.
Electric bicycles have become a popular and sustainable way for people of all ages to get around without a car. But as Summit County Sheriff's spokesperson Skylar Talbot says, they also create new safety concerns for kids in particular.
We're very fortunate that we haven't had a more serious accident with these e-bikes. We're fortunate that we haven't had one of our youth seriously injured or killed. It's happened across the state, across the country with these e-bikes.
In early May, a car and a youth on an e-bike had a close call when they collided on the intersection of Kilby Road and Pine Brook Boulevard. The car clipped the bike's back tire and the child sustained minor scratches, Talbot says. The sheriff's office did not establish that any one party was at fault. Then on May 22nd, deputies say another child was operating an electric motorcycle at reckless speeds in the lower Pine Brook area. A deputy gave chase and the kid hid behind a house before a witness told the deputy where they were. The child involved was detained, cited for multiple offenses, and released to his mother. The e-motorcycle was impounded.
The majority of the e-bikes, and you can't see, but I'm putting e-bikes in air quotes, under state statute, they're just simply not e-bikes.
Talbot says parents can help by educating themselves on what level of e-bike or e-motorcycle they're buying for their kids and how fast they can go. Talbot says kids and drivers can help by practicing caution. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.